Welcome back. You have found us here. It's Wooden Sticks on the Talk North Podcast Network. My name is Kevin Gorg, the host of the show. And, you know, we're going to have all kinds of different guests as this journey is just getting going. And we've already had some wonderful hockey conversations. And it's always a little different when it's somebody that you work with almost on a daily basis. That'll be the case today. Wes Walls will be our guest. And for Wild fans, it doesn't get any better, right? I mean, this is a guy that's now been broadcasting for about a decade with us at Bally Sports North, a longtime player in the organization, still a part of the team that made the deepest run in the playoffs. And I guess for all of us that are of a certain age, and I'm now in my, we'll call it mid to late 50s, that grew up loving the North Stars. I was obsessed with hockey as a kid, and I grew up in Burnsville, so probably, what, a 10-minute drive to the old Met Center in Bloomington. And the North Stars were my world as a young man. And when they eventually left town in 1993, they took a big part of my heart and a lot of hockey fans' hearts here in town. And it took a while for all of us to warm back up to the idea of another team. There was some bitterness, not only with Norm Green, who still sucks, but also with the National Hockey League for taking the team away from a hockey market like ours and from some great fans that had supported the North Stars. And I know there were some lean years. I know you can throw out the attendance numbers and what have you, but to take the North Stars down to Dallas and then to watch them win a cup was, it was tough for all of us. And I think even though we all had season tickets early on, when the team came back, so my buddies I grew up with and played hockey with in Burnsville, the Paul Lewis's, the Mike Luckcrafts and that group, Andy Luckcraft, great people, great friends still to this day. We all got in on some tickets and shared season tickets. And we had, a lot of us had young families at that time, so going to the entire home slate wasn't really realistic. So we divided those tickets up and usually went to 10, 15, 20 games a year. And it took us a couple years to really get all in. And I guess the moment I'll point to is in 2003, when the Wild made the playoffs for the very first time. And when Andrew Burnett scored that goal in overtime to defeat the Colorado Avalanche in Denver at the, I think it was called the Pepsi Center at that time. It was a moment in time I'll never forget. I still get chills watching that replay back. And I think at that point, we put the ghosts of the North Stars to bed, right? And just said, okay, we're moving on. You've got us now. They validated that upset win, and it was a huge upset that Wes Walls was a part of by beating the Vancouver Canucks in the next round. And both those series, they were down 3-1. Both those series, they had to come back and winning the opponent's territory in Game 7. Just remarkable stuff. And from that point on, it's been completely different. I was a fan for all those early years while I was still coaching, and that all changed in 2006 when I joined the broadcast team. I've been covering the Minnesota Wild ever since, and Wes is a great friend. And more importantly, he's a great hockey mind. And so a lot of times on Wooden Sticks, we're only talking about the past. We're going back to, you know, when these men or women started the game and they're icons and they're superstars. And you want to kind of dive into some of that. And we'll get to that with Wes for sure. Grew up in Calgary, drafted by the Boston Bruins, had a great career. But I really want to tap into his knowledge about the Minnesota Wild today. So I'm going to dive deep into Kirill Kaprizov. We're going to compare him to Marian Gabrick. And I'm going to put Wes on the spot today with two questions that revolve around Kirill Kaprizov and the Stanley Cup right here in Minnesota. I want his honest opinion on that. I think they're kind of tied together. And then we'll walk back to those Jacques Lemaire days and walk back to that unbelievable series in 2003. It's going to be an unbelievable hockey conversation. I can't wait to hear the passion that Wes Walls has. You see it on our broadcast. You know this guy knows the game. He was such a fierce competitor and the heart and soul of those Wild teams that really captured our hearts and our imagination back in the early 2000s. So that's going to be terrific. And I'm excited to announce that we've got some terrific new sponsors here on Wooden Sticks. And we'll start with this one. When people think of the Freemasons, they often think of secret handshakes and unusual hats and, of course, the pancake breakfast. Minnesota Masonic Charities would prefer that you think about the work that they do right here, guys, in our community. Places like the Masonic Cancer Center at the University of Minnesota or the Masonic Children's Hospital and the Masonic Home in Bloomington. They are just a few examples of the important work that the Freemasons support here in Minnesota. As part of the largest fraternal organization in the world, Masons have consistently answered the call when it comes to charitable needs. I am so happy that Minnesota Masonic Charities has chosen our podcast as a place to help spread the word. We look forward to learning more about their many programs right here on Wooden Sticks in the weeks to come. Don't forget about Beta Bay. It's that time, right? Spring has sprung. We saw 80s here last week, and 80s in Minnesota. The Boat Club, Beta Bay.
Beta Bay Boat Club offers a limited number of season-long memberships in our private club and half-day or full-day pontoon boat rentals on Lake Minnetonka. Members have the opportunity to play on luxurious pontoon boats, as well as a variety of well-appointed deck boats, speed boats, and offshore boats. Our daily pontoon boats are deluxe, custom-built boats with many amenities and comfortable seating for up to 14 people. Beta Bay Boat Club, Country Club Boating, 24 years in business and voted Minnesota's best 3 years in a row. Please visit us at betabayboatclub.com for more information. We look forward to welcoming you this summer.
Thank you to both those great sponsors. And if you want to be a part of the show, we'd love to have you join us. Karen Cleary has the hookup, K-C-L-E-A-R-Y, at talknorth.com. Karen Cleary, the one for all of your answers. We'll pump it up right here on Wooden Sticks. And when we come back, a hockey conversation with the great Wes Walls. All right, folks, we're back on Wooden Sticks, as promised. My dear friend and co-worker, Wes Walls, former captain of the Minnesota Wild, is our special guest today. And Wes, looking forward to this hockey conversation.
Yeah, so am I. It's been, I know we're going to touch a little bit on the 0-3 run that happened, 21 years ago, 22 years ago. It feels like it's yesterday. And, you know, anytime I get a chance to sit down with you, and, you know, we're on the road quite a bit together, there's a lot of hot stoving going on, a lot of hockey talk. So it's going to be fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to going down memory lane and, you know, kind of building to the playoffs this year, flashing back to the greatest playoff run in Wild franchise history. But the news of the week, and we kind of had some conversations about this in the last couple of weeks working together, is what would Marc-Andre Fleury decide to do? We knew that Bill Guerin and the Wild would welcome back with open arms. Didn't know if he wanted to play another year. What was your reaction when you got that news?
Well, everybody got that news earlier today, and I was very excited. He obviously, KG played a lot more this year than I think we envisioned him playing. I think he ended up getting to 38 or 39 games, which is probably a lot more than they expected him to play, because you know, Gus struggled with his game off and on all season long. So, I mean, if you look at his overall numbers, I think his save percentage was just under 90%. You know, had he maybe not played quite as much because the other goaltender would have maybe played a little bit better, his numbers could have been a little bit better. But to get him in the mix right now and lock him in, knowing he's going to be back for another year, gives Billy Guerin some options, right? And at the back end, as far as who's going to play goal next year, I mean, there's still a lot of questions going into the summer. And I think you would agree, KG, like, who is Gus? Who's Gustafson? Is he the goalie that we saw, 2 years ago when he went on that amazing run the last half of the season? Or is he the goalie that we saw this year that was very, very inconsistent? So there's a lot of questions in the goaltending area. And one of which is, who is Gus? And then the other one is Jesper Wallstedt, is he ready? Is he ready to play in the National Hockey League? And, you know, obviously the other question we had was, does Marc-Andre Fleury want to play? And I guess we got that answer today. So a lot of questions kind of going into the summer about how the goaltending situation is going to play out next year. But getting Marc-Andre back into the mix is huge news for the Minnesota Wild. And I know, Kevin, you're excited because he's an unbelievable, you're a goaltender. He's an unbelievable interview. And so I know you're jacked up. I don't even have to ask you.
I'm very excited. And I'm excited for the team too. I think he's a great influence, especially on the younger players on this roster. And so no matter which goalie is part of the tandem next year, whether it's Jesper or Gus, they're going to be better long-term for having more time with Marc-Andre Fleury, the way he practices, the way he competes, the way he works out, the way he takes care of himself, the attitude he has every day. This is a guy that's going to make everybody else better And because he's a Hall of Famer, I think that there's a lot of credibility there. And I think you mentioned it, Wes. This gives Bill Guerin some options. And you know, Gus was inconsistent this year, but he closed late in the season with maybe some of his strongest play. I loved his game in L.A. And you wonder if Bill Guerin's going to, again, like he did at trade deadline, listen to some options in the trade market. Because one thing we learned about Jesper Wallstedt is he reacted pretty well after that debacle of a debut in Dallas. He went back to Iowa, worked on his game, came back a better goalie, and put together two good games. Now, again, against Chicago and San Jose, so you've got to understand that he wasn't playing the elite competition in the National Hockey League, but I don't care who you're playing. You still got to go out there and make saves, and he did that. So it's interesting that Bill Guerin has those options, and I think the biggest question mark I have, Wes, is will they make a trade and trust Wallstedt to step in next year, or will they give him another year of seasoning? Because goaltenders take, as you know, a lot longer to get to that place where they're in the sweet spot of their career, and this kid's still awfully young.
Yeah, he is very young, and obviously he's played 2 years in the American Hockey League, but you know, you look at the last two games he played. Yes, it was against Chicago and San Jose, but just watching the way he moved around the crease, he looked much more comfortable in net. There was no second guessing the way he was moving around the net. And I thought actually the last half of the San Jose game, which has been his third game in the NHL, I thought the last half of that game, he just looked really, really clean. Like you could tell that his confidence had grown. And you know, getting Wallstedt in these last two games, considering what happened in the Dallas game, is going to serve him well going back home this summer, being able to train, knowing what he's going to, you know, knowing what to expect next year. And then as far as what Billy Guerin is going to do with Gus, I mean, you know, we're around the team for sure, KG, during the course of the season, but we don't really know all the detail about what the organization knows about Gus, if they're happy with certain areas, you know, but and for them, their decision on what they're going to do with Gus is probably clearer than it is for somebody like you or I. But you know, I just, if you're going to go with Wallstedt and Marc-Andre Fleury, what better a mentor could you look up to you know, to have a guy like Marc-Andre Fleury, who's going to play in the Hall of Fame, who actually played in the National Hockey League as a 19, 20-year-old goaltender as well. And to be honest with you, you look back at Marc-Andre's numbers at the beginning of his career, his first 70 games, KG, in the NHL, they didn't go great. They didn't go great. So it took him a while to really figure out how to play in the National Hockey League. And for a guy like Wallstedt that would have somebody to play with Marc-Andre Fleury, someone that's been there, done that, would it's going to pay huge dividends for a guy like Wallstedt. So again, a lot of questions around the goaltending situation, and it'll be an intriguing and interesting summer here for the Minnesota Wild in that area.
Yeah, they've got depth at that position. If they get healthy on the blue line, which it looks like they will, they're going to have great depth there up front. It's all about number 97. And I've been waiting to ask you this question, and I'm not sure we've had this conversation, but you played in your tenure with the Minnesota Wild with Marian Gaborik. And until just a couple years ago, he was absolutely the best player to ever put on a sweater in this organization. He was fantastic, went on to win a couple of Stanley Cups. So in your opinion, separate Kirill Kaprizov from Marian Gaborik and their skill set. And if you could have an answer, who would be the better player?
Well, I mean, for me, they're completely different. They're completely different players, in my opinion. Marian was a burner and a speedster that could skate in straight lines, 100 miles an hour, had an unbelievable NHL like superstar release. He could get rid of the puck off of his stick so fast, and he was like a pure sniper. Kirill Kaprizov is more of a, I wouldn't consider him a burner like Marian, but he's more of an agile skater. And to be honest with you, when I say agile, it doesn't even do it justice. Like the way he skates should be studied almost. Like that's how good he is. I've never seen a hockey player be able to have his feet move the way he does. I mean, we've watched him now for 2 or 3 years, Kirill Kaprizov. There's so many times during a game where he'll be down in the corner. And a perfect example was the last goal he scored when he banked it off the side of Talbot's head the other night. Like how did he create 5 feet of separation in the corner when there was nothing going on? Like, and if you look at his footwork there and break it down. He just did one little shuffle and was able to create so much space. So yes, he can score. We all know that he can score. He's got 45 goals again this year, or 44, whatever he's got. 3 years in a row, he's got 40. I wouldn't consider him a pure goal scorer like Marian Gaborik, but Marian can't match Kirill Kaprizov at all as far as like moving the puck and passing the puck. Kirill has the ability, KG, to make other people around him better because of his ability to come up with loose pucks on the forecheck. And he's a much gifted passer than Marian ever was. But honestly, both unbelievable hockey players, as you know, played with Marian for many, many years. But Kirill's on a level by himself, KG. And to be honest with you, it's not even close.
Yeah, I enjoy watching him so much. And our broadcast season ended last weekend in San Jose, and I was watching the game the other night on the nationally televised broadcast. And I just, every time he's out there, I literally move to the edge of my chair just naturally. I can't get enough of watching his creativity. And you hit the nail on the head. That play in the corner, 99 out of 100 times for any other player in the league becomes nothing. And he turns it into not only a scoring chance, but a goal. He has that innate ability to create offense with his skill set, to create space. I've never seen anybody, at least in a Wild sweater, that's able to do it so easily. And every time he's on the ice, it just feels like the Wild are going to get a great chance to score. And that's pretty impressive because right now, the way this team is set up with the injuries they've had, Wes, every team knows that that's the only line that can probably do damage. So they're doing everything they can, the matchups, to stop him. Like they're putting their very best out there and they can't stop him. To me, it's incredible.
Yeah, they've got him highlighted and double circled in the locker room. This is the guy that we have to stop. And I mean, let's be honest, these last 15 games or so, I mean, we know what he's done in the second half of the season, which is, I think his point differential was right at the top of the league from the beginning of the season, first half of the season to the second half. But like the way he played the last 15, 20 games, I mean, it was just, we couldn't even do it justice talking about it. It was just remarkable to watch. Every time he was on the ice, it didn't matter if you were on the road or away and the other team got last change. If he had to play against the other team's best defensive players, they couldn't stop him. They couldn't stop that line of Boldy, Eck, and even Zuccarello played a little bit down the stretch with Kirill. But most of the damage was done by Kirill and I don't know if they taught math over there in Russia, but Kirill Kaprizov had played like he had no idea that we were mathematically eliminated from the playoffs the last six games and the way he was flying around the ice. But just the fact that we get a chance to watch him play every night in a Wild uniform, KG, is just like it's really, really special. And he obviously, we know what Nathan MacKinnon can do, and we know what Connor McDavid can do, and guys like Kucherov. He's right up where they're up there with those guys, KG. And the other thing that doesn't get talked about with Kirill, Kevin, is we've been playing 14, $15 million under the cap hit. Think about Kirill after we get out of this cap situation we're in for one more year, and he gets another $6-7 million defenseman that can just skate the puck out of the zone. And so we don't have to spend as much time in our own zone, or maybe we go pick up another $5-6 million forward that can play with him. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
he, I don't know if we've even seen the best of what Kirill Kaprizov can bring, because we've played the last 3 years under his tenure here, 3-4 years with just a terrible cap situation, trying to get out from under the Suter and Parise deal. So I don't even know if we've scratched the surface yet on what Kirill Kaprizov could be here, even in a couple of years.
Yeah, and there's been stretches where another line has created a situation where teams have to defend. It hasn't happened consistently, to your point. Mm-hmm. If you bring in another player and you develop another kid like a Liam Ogren, and in another year or two, you have two good scoring lines, and maybe the matchups are just a little bit different. I'm with you. I don't think we've seen anything close to the ceiling. My question to you is, have you ever played with or been around an NHL player that enjoys hockey more than Kirill Kaprizov? We are privileged enough to be with this team at the hotel, at the practice rink, on the road, up close, watching these games live. I've never, in my 18 years of doing this job, I've never been around a player that seems to be having more fun at the rink. And I'm talking both games and practice. He won't leave the ice after practice. And I just don't know if you've been around a guy in your career that's ever enjoyed hockey like Kirill does.
Well, let's see what happens when he has a couple kids. He might leave a little earlier. He doesn't have any kids yet, KG.
That's a good point. No, that's a really good point.
Not going to go home too yet, but I was probably not that far off earlier in my career too. But you can just tell anytime he puts his equipment on, he's got a smile on his face. And, somebody brought up a great point about his leadership. Now his English has gotten a little bit better. He's doing interviews without an interpreter after games. And that's kind of his next step as far as being a leader in that locker room is learning the English language. And I never played in a Wild uniform with a player like that, but I couldn't imagine how cool it would be walking out the tunnel every night, knowing that you've got the best player on the ice every game that you pretty much go in and play. I never had that luxury those early years with those Minnesota Wild teams, but he's very, very special. And I think he's got, is it two more years, KG, under his contract right now?
Two more to go. And that leads me to this question. I promised our loyal listeners I would put your great hockey mind on the spot. There's no wrong answer here, Wes, but I would love your opinion. These next two questions are absolutely yes or absolutely no. If you had to lay a wager on this, does Kirill Kaprizov play his entire career with the Minnesota Wild? Yes or no? And again, there's no wrong answer.
Yeah. Yes.
So you think he wants to play here? He's happy in Minnesota and he doesn't want to venture? Because, you know, some of the negatives have said, oh, he wants to go to a bigger market like New York. And knowing him, and again, we've all gotten to know him slowly but surely with the language barrier early on, which the wall is kind of coming down there and we're starting to really get to know his personality. I don't agree with those negatives. I don't know that he'd love a big city like New York.
He didn't grow up in a big city. He grew up in northern Russia, like basically farmland. That's why that guy's wired the way it is. And I'm not saying he couldn't end up in New York or one of those other teams, but what is going to be important too is when we get out of this cap situation that last year, before he goes into a contract season, it's going to be the Wild need to have a great start to the season. They need to, get off to a good start. And I feel like the way Kirill plays here and the relationship that he has with our fans. I mean, honestly, you go to the Wild game and you're up in the press box looking down. Every fourth person you're looking at the lower bowl when you're looking at the fans' backs, every fourth person's got a Kirill jersey on. He sits around and signs autographs. I just get the impression that he's a very, very loyal person and player. And that doesn't mean that he doesn't, he may end up going somewhere else. I don't know. I honestly don't even want my mind to go there, to be perfectly honest with you, KG, because I just want to watch this guy play. So you said answer the question. I did. I said, no, he ain't going anywhere.
All right. My next question ties into that. Our dear friend Ryan Carter mentioned at one point during our broadcast this year that Stanley Cups seem to follow superstars. You think of players that have won the Cup, Ovechkin recently, Jonathan Toews, Sidney Crosby, even Jack Eichel. Kirill Kaprizov is a superstar. So if you had to bet hard-earned money right now on a yes or no question, does Kirill Kaprizov win a Stanley Cup before it's all said and done?
Yes. I'm going to say he is. I mean, obviously he's got only 10 years. He's 26 years old. He spent four of his first years of his career playing the KHL over there. So I would agree with Karts. If you look at the teams that have won Stanley Cups, the Chicago's, the LA Kings, the Tampa Bay Lightning, these teams that all have superstars, they have a guy on their team that can will their team to win. We just saw what Sidney Crosby almost did. Almost got their team into the playoffs. We've been watching it for 20 years. So you don't have to go. You look out year in, year out. And I agree 100% with what Karts is saying. If you want to win a Stanley Cup, you got to have one or two of those guys that can play 24 minutes as a forward and, a defenseman that can handle big, big minutes. And I do think that he's going to win a Stanley Cup in his in his career. And I just think he's just such an amazingly driven athlete that I just think he's going to will himself one of these years.
I love it. Now, we're going to go back in time 21 years ago. And this is for just hockey fans. And that's what it comes down to. I mean, we love the game. And even though the Wild aren't going to be there and it's a big bummer this year, I'm still just a fan of mapping out what the playoffs are going to look like and the matchups. So take us back 21 years ago, right about now, when you guys wrapped up that regular season and finally got to see, okay, we made it. We made the playoffs for almost a brand new organization. That's a big deal. And then you find out you're playing Patrick Waugh, Joe Sakic, Forsberg, all these stud players, Colorado being the big dog out there, the betting favorite to win the cup. And what was that week like when you found out who you were playing and when the coaching staff tried to put together a plan where you guys could start to attack and find a way to, you know, at this point, I think you're just looking to be competitive in a series against a team on paper you were very overmatched against.
Well, the last game of the season, I don't know if you remember this, KG, or not, but we played at home. We played at home against Columbus and we won in the afternoon. And I remember being across the street with Richard Park and Pascal Dupuis and a bunch of the wives. We went over to eat dinner and the Vancouver Canucks played the Los Angeles Kings at home. And if Vancouver would have won that game, we would have played Colorado. No, we would have played Vancouver in the first round. Okay. So we were thinking, of course, Vancouver wants to play us, right? So they ended up losing that game 2-0 at home against the Los Angeles Kings. So that's how we actually hooked Colorado. And I remember after that game was over, thinking to myself, and actually I even mentioned, you know, Richard Park talking about it and go, this is going to be a tall order for sure. But the more you thought about the matchup, you know, playing Colorado in the first round, I remember the next day we went into practice, we knew who we were going to play. And back then the coaches brought out an easel with a paper and markers and stuff. And they wrote everybody's line. They wrote up the names of the other opponents and, you know, they put our lines underneath their nines or actually up on top. So it made us look bigger. And then, so we always had that easel to look at before we flew up to Colorado and, you know, not many, you know, pundits around the National Hockey League gave us much chance in that first series, Kevin. And you remember, not many thought we would even win one game, but I got to be perfectly honest with you, Kevin. And I'm telling you the truth. We had one of the best defensive teams in the National Hockey League, and we were so confident, that we could not only win one or two games against Colorado, we did believe that we could beat them. We were a very, very fast team. We were as fast as they were. And we felt going into the series that we had the better two goalies. And I was looking, doing some homework here earlier today, and I didn't realize this, but, you know, Dwayne Roloson had a 927 and Manny Fernandez a 924 during that season. They both split the games half and half, so they were fresh. And, yes, they had Patrick Waugh at the other end of the ice, was kind of near the end of his career. So we thought we matched up pretty good against them, especially the fact that we had a guy like Jacques Lemaire, who was one of the best bench coaches basically that's ever lived, gave us an unbelievable opportunity with matchups, trying to get certain guys on the ice at certain times. We had a team in the locker room that was all team first. Guys didn't get bent out of shape if guys were changing on the fly, coming in and out. So no one gave us much of a chance, Kevin. But I'm telling you, the guys in the locker room, we really, really did believe that we had a really good chance to not only just win a few games, we did feel that we had a chance to win the series.
I'm always fascinated with the game within the game and some of the psychological warfare that might go on, specifically on the ice early in that series. Were the Colorado guys, you know, at the faceoff dots or maybe during warmups or in any of your conversations in some of the scrums that happen in playoff hockey, was there any commentary early in that series basically demeaning you guys and basically saying, you know, you're wasting your time, this is going to be a short series? Was there any of that that took place that maybe kind of fueled the fire?
I would say no. Their leader was Joe Sakic, right? He was a very soft-spoken guy. So he kind of led the troops. They were they were all business, the Colorado Avalanche. But I do remember standing on the blue line for the national anthem. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, we had the easel in the locker room and look at all the lines. Oh, and you can walk by that and go, yeah, we can match up pretty good against this team. But I'll never forget KG standing on the blue line. I was in the starting lineup and we're facing the national anthem and I could see all the backs of their jerseys and Patrick Waugh, Adam Foote, Rob Blake, Sakic and Forsberg. I believe that they were both on the ice. They eventually, as the series went on, they split them up, but I think they started game one together. And that's when it really hit me like, oh my goodness, this is a pretty good squad we're playing over there. But to answer your question, no, I don't. There was nothing where they were sending messages about yapping or talking, but I do think we had them down in game one, Kevin, 3-0. We punched them in the nose pretty good. And so going into game one, I think they kind of overlooked us for sure. We ended up winning game one in there 4-2. So we punched them in the nose really early just to let them know, like, listen, yeah, we might be, you know, we have a difficult time scoring goals, but we can defend. And if you're not ready, we're going to be able to play with you guys. And so as the series went on, it just it was just such a tight series. You know, I think about game two. Now we've won game one. Game two, we lost that game in a real tight 3-2 game. So we very easily could have won both those games in Colorado, but we come home with a 1-1, series, get the home ice advantage back and then come back home for game three and game four. And as you know, we lost both those games, KG. And KG, those two games we played at home against Colorado, we held them to 39 shots in two games. We lost both of those games. That's how good we played. Could have very easily been up. Could have very easily been up 3-1, and we're down 3-1. Rolly had a tough game in game four. I think he got pulled. He got pulled like 10 minutes into the first period. So Jock saw something there that he wasn't happy with. We almost climbed back and won that game, but you know, then we obviously went. Got a chance to play in game five, and then the next three games, obviously. Goaltending change happened and Manny got a chance to jump in there for the last three games. And we kind of just went on a roll and felt really good about our games, but we had a lot of things that we had to deal with too, as far as getting past Colorado and going back to game seven, thinking about how that game played out. I would say game seven in that series, KG, was probably the worst. This is why hockey is the weirdest sport ever. Was by far the worst game that we played in all seven games. And if Manny doesn't stand on his head in game seven, you know, we don't even talk about Vancouver or anything else. Manny stole that game for us. And obviously we know how it finished with Andrew Brunette scoring the overtime winner, but this is just an incredible series.
Yeah. And that winning goal, I got to tell you, as a hockey junkie and a Wild fan at my heart of hearts, I go back, I don't know, for sure, when the playoffs start, I'll do that this week, into the weekend. I'll go back and watch the play unfold live on the broadcast on YouTube. And I've gone back well over 100 times to watch that goal. My question to you is your vantage point on that goal. And to me, when I watch it, it almost slows down to the point where you feel like it's in slow motion because the Avalanche were kind of caught flat-footed. And the way Brunette makes that play. So take us back to live game action, where you were, and then the feeling that I mean, I get chills just watching the TV broadcast being a fan. I can't imagine what it's like for you guys as players. So take us back to your vantage point, and then when the puck goes in and you realize that you just beat the Avalanche, what the next couple of minutes were like.
Well, we were down. I don't know if you remember, but we were down 2-1 with about 7 minutes left in that game. And, for me, one of the biggest goals of that series was the goal that tied it up at 2-2. I believe it was Marion scored on a power play goal with maybe 5 or 6 minutes left after Rob Blake had taken a terrible charging penalty and gave us an opportunity to score on the power play. So we had some serious momentum going into overtime in game seven. And we scored 3 minutes into overtime, KG. And if you go back and watch the overtime, and I haven't watched it as closely as you have. You said you've watched it 100 times.
Many times.
I haven't watched it closely, but if there's 3 minutes of time before Bruno scored his goal, I'll bet you we never spent more than 20 seconds in the offensive zone in those 3 minutes. So we were in our own zone a lot. I remember the first shift of overtime I started, and I was on the ice, and we didn't get out of our own zone. They had the puck the whole time. And now that doesn't mean that we were in trouble, KG, because we spent a lot of time in our own zone, but we were so comfortable there. There was never, ever any panic when we were in our own zone, just because we were so comfortable being uncomfortable. Like, it just, this was how we're going to win. We're going to play in our own zone. You're going to stay on the outside. We're not chasing you anywhere. And that was kind of a microcosm of what our team was about. The other team would get frustrated and then take stupid penalties and then maybe cheat offensively. And all of a sudden, boom, we'd get a 2-on-2 or a 3-on-2 the other way. And we had enough guys that could score that could make you pay. But yeah, it does. When you go back, and I was on the bench watching that play unfold, and Bruno and Sergei Zoltok were wingers. I think Darbs, I don't know if, you know, no, Jimmy Dowd was on the ice, because I still remember him raising his hand. So Jimmy Dowd was on the ice, and he had been in his own zone a long time. And as you know, as a centerman, when you're in your own zone, you're the one expending a whole lot of the energy. So Bruno and Sergei Zoltok were in their own zone for a minute, but they were watching the D-men. They still, when we finally got the puck back, they were the only two Wild players that had any juice left at all. And I remember Bruno saying that he actually wanted to dump the puck in and try to get off of the ice, but he had enough juice. He said, well, it looks like they're backing off here a little bit. Maybe they're going to, they gave me the blue line, and then Sergei blew through, and then Adam Foote kind of had a bad angle, and he was able to break him down. And Bruno hasn't blown by anybody in his career, but he was able to step around. I think it was Adam Foote. I'm not 100% yep. sure, but he was able to step around Adam Foote and then got alone there with Patrick Roy and was able to pull to his backhand and put in the empty net. And that was quite a moment in Wild lore.
I'll never forget the Star Tribune the next morning had a large color picture of Andrew Brunette right after the puck went in. And in big, bold black letters above that picture was just one word, and it was believe. And I remember talking to my assistant coaches. I was coaching the women's team at St. Thomas at that time, and we got that cover of the paper onto a placard and got it laminated and put one in each locker for our players before the playoffs, because we were kind of the underdog that year against Gustavus, who had won the regular season title. And it paid off because it motivated our team. And it's funny, the ripple effect of that win. You came back from 3-1 down in that series. You did the exact same thing against Vancouver in round two. What I can't get over, we've had this conversation before, is, you know, I just looked at the Timberwolves schedule now, as they're going to open up the playoffs this weekend against the Phoenix Suns. And yeah, they have like 3 and 4 days in between these games. And at some point there's like 5 days in between games. And what I remember most about those two series is, correct me if I'm wrong, but game 6 and game 7 in both series were back to back. And in the Vancouver series, you're flying from Minnesota to Vancouver to play, both teams are, to play game 7 the next day. Wes, I still can't believe that. It's crazy.
I know. I know. And actually, we were the Minnesota Wild, right? We were the old expansion team. So I think we got a lot of the crappy draws as far as the television, because less people were probably watching the Wild, right? They were watching all the big heavy hitters all the time. So I think that maybe played a little bit of a role. Basketball is a whole different animal. It almost feels like they want to play on weekends. So they get a lot more time to rest and recover. But there was, obviously we look back at the schedule of the games and things like that, but I got to be honest, when you're in the middle of it, KG, you just know you play tomorrow and you got to travel and you're just ready to go. The other team has to do the same thing. So we never really thought too much about it, to be perfectly honest.
All right. This is Wooden Sticks. We are with Wes Walls. I'm Kevin Gorg, the host of the program, and we got to take it all the way back. You grew up in Calgary. I imagine your first hockey stick that you can remember, I had a Northland goalie stick, the same one that Tony Esposito used in the mid to late 70s for the Chicago Blackhawks. How far back does your memory go with the first hockey stick that you ever called your own?
Oh, that's a great question. There's a pretty good story behind that one too. I think I was obviously we used to skate on the, we skated a lot on the outdoor ice growing up, and there was a place called the Shack that we used to go skate all the time. And we used to have our practices. I would have been probably 10, maybe 9, 10 or 11 years old. And I remember being on the ice for actual practice one afternoon or whatever, maybe it was on a weekend. And I had this wooden stick. It was a straight blade. And some of the other players had like curved, they had these new things called curved sticks or whatever. So, and I'm dating myself. I can't believe this, but there were a couple kids, maybe that had curved sticks, but you know, my dad didn't come from a lot of money. He was one of 16 kids and farm boy. And, you know, so I just remember the coach accidentally stepping on my stick and broke my favorite stick. And I remember driving home after practice and crying on the way home. And either later, I think it might have been that night or the next day, the coach showed up at our door and he bought me a brand new wooden, like a curved stick. And I'll never, ever forget going out on the ice and actually playing with a curved stick and how much harder you could shoot the puck and actually raise the puck. It was unbelievable. So I can't remember what kind of a stick. I think it was probably one of those old like Titans. Do you remember the old Titans?
I do. They were awesome.
Yeah. And you know what? Those sticks there, you never broke them. You just kind of wore them out, you know?
And I
used that stick not only for the games, I used it for street hockey and I used it for knee hockey downstairs. So so that was kind of my my first experience with the first little hockey stick was the coach actually accidentally stepping on my stick and breaking it and then going to buy me a new one. That was a day that I'll never forget. And I haven't forgotten to this point.
And growing up in Calgary, a lot like growing up in Minnesota, maybe even more so. Just a hockey hotbed. Everybody in town probably played the game. Who was your very first hockey hero when you were a little kid, Wes?
My first hockey hero was Lanny McDonald.
What a mustache.
Yeah. And I ended up getting a chance to meet Lanny a little bit later in life because he's works with the Calgary Flames alumni, and I had a chance to play a couple years with the Calgary Flames. But so when I was, again, about 10 years old or whatever, I remember my mother telling me a story. The Toronto Maple Leafs were playing on TV, and I watched Hockey Night in Canada all the time. And they played most every Saturday night. So I was always watching Toronto Maple Leaf games. And I remember my mom telling me one time, she's like, oh, you know that guy there with a mustache? I went to school with him. And I'm like, you went to school with him? And he said, yeah, we grew up in Hanna, Alberta. And I went to school with Lanny. We were the same age. And so I'm like, wow, my mom went to school with an NHL player. So anytime I watched a Toronto Maple Leafs game, I always watched for Lanny McDonald. He was a right-handed hockey player, and so was I. That helped for sure, too. And then I remember sending a letter to him to the Maple Leaf Gardens. I wrote him a letter and talked to him about you went to school with my mother. You're one of my favorite players. Could you ever send me a picture? Not knowing if I would get anything back at all, KG or anything. And I can't remember exactly when I wrote the letter, what time of year it was or whatever, but 2-3 months later, something did show up in the mail, and it was a letter. It was like a hockey card that was probably five times the size of what a hockey card looks like today. And it's him standing in a Toronto Maple Leafs jersey wearing number 7 with a mustache. He doesn't have a helmet on because it's off the ice. And he said, "Dear Wesley, say hello to your mother for me. I still remember her when we went to school. Just something along the lines, continue to work hard and always follow your dreams." And he had such an impact on me. And then later in life, having a chance to actually talk to him and meet him and tell him the story again. Obviously, he didn't remember sending the letter, but I had talked to him about what my mother's maiden name was. And he's like, "Oh yeah, I remember all the Schnur girls and Schnur boys. My mom come from a family of 6 and they all kind of grew up around the same farm where Lanny grew up." So anyway, he remembered the family name, and for me to share that with him meant a lot to him and also to me as a young boy.
That's so cool. And it just makes, again, he was always one of those players that was a guy I loved watching. And when he finally won the cup, the emotion that he showed, to have that tie into your family directly to your mom. I mean, that's just, well, that then, to me, yeah, is what's so special.
Him, KG, for him to actually win a Stanley Cup playing for the Calgary Flames, like, yes, years later, I still remember him scoring that big goal in Montreal after.
Yes.
And then turning in the corner. That was for us, I was like 19 years old. And, we were playing the Montreal Canadiens to win the Stanley Cup. And Lanny scored that big goal. He wasn't playing a whole lot back then. It was near the end of his career, but he got a chance to play in that series a little bit. And he scored a huge goal. That guy had scored 66 goals in a season once. That guy knew what to do around the net. So to have Lanny have a chance to win a Stanley Cup as a leader for the Calgary Flames in 1989 with, guys like Neuendijk and Roberts and Fleury and Vernon and Jim Poplinski and all those names. And the fact that I grew up in Calgary, it was the first and only time the Calgary Flames won a Stanley Cup. And watching Lanny raise the cup was very special, just because of my own little connection with Lanny and our family.
And he had asked you to follow your dreams. And around that same time frame, some of those dreams kind of come to fruition. In 1989, you're drafted 57th overall by the Boston Bruins, an original six team. And I just can't even imagine for you and your family what that moment was like, Wes, when you got the news that not only were you going to be drafted, but by an organization like the Boston Bruins. That had to be monumental for everybody in your family.
Well, it was amazing. And actually, back then when I got drafted, Kevin, near the end of the third round, I don't know, I can't remember all the rules back then, but that year I could only be drafted in the first three rounds. Like, I couldn't get drafted in the fourth round because of my age. I don't know how it all worked.
Oh, but sure.
Yeah. And actually the draft was actually at the Met Center. So my career actually went completely full. Yeah. My career actually went completely full circle, starting at the Met Center where I was drafted by the Bruins and then ending down the road in St. Paul. But I was drafted 57th overall, and there were about three or four teams that basically told me 100%, if I'm available in the third round, they will take me. I'll never forget the teams. It was the Washington Capitals, it was the Hartford Whalers, and the Buffalo Sabres, those three teams. And they all had picks near, like, probably the last 10 picks of the third round. Their picks came and gone, and they did not draft me. And I remember looking over at my dad, and I'm like, I think it's over. I don't think I'm going to get drafted. I'm sitting in the building, right? I flew out there because there's a good chance I'm going to get, like, really good chance I'm going to get drafted. So I was so disappointed. And then I never talked, KG, Boston never even talked to me. It was one of the teams that never talked to me. They've got this small rink out there, the Boston Garden, that's about the size of your coffee table that you put your feet up on when you're watching the Wild in the regular season. So they ended up drafting me, and it was an amazing day that day to finally get drafted to the National Hockey League. And obviously I had a chance to play 17 years in the NHL, and it was the first 6 years of my career, KG, was a real tough struggle trying to figure out how to play in the NHL. To be perfectly honest with you, I had no business being in the NHL. I should have played the first 2 years in the American Hockey League. I wasn't ready mentally. I wasn't mature enough to handle the pressure of playing in the National Hockey League. And I think that's a big reason why my career had to go over to Switzerland. And fortunately, I was able to come back and I was a better player. But, all these young kids that come over and play, like Marco Rossi, and I watch Matt Boldy and all these young kids, and we go through this all the time. Whether these kids should be going back to the American League or whether they should stay in the National Hockey League. Anytime I get asked, and I talk about it, even if I'm during on a broadcast, I'll bring up, I always default back to my own situation and what I went through. Mm-hmm. Less is more. Like, if you're not ready, and it's a difficult league to try to figure out how to play if you're not ready. And I love the way Billy Guerin goes about his business, because I believe he has the same philosophy. And he's willing to hold guys back and keep them in the American Hockey League and have them. The longer you can keep them down there, the better they're going to be in their careers. I lived it myself, had no business playing for the Boston Bruins when I was 20 years old, and really struggled. It was up and down and wasn't sure whether I could ever play. And so I ended up going over to Switzerland for a fuse. And then fortunately, the NHL expanded and I was able to get one more crack at it. And then obviously play the last 8 years of my career with the Wild, which I'll forever be grateful.
And just watching the way you played the game, the passion you had for it, this will be my last question before we get to the hat trick hot seat. But what is the one thing you miss more than anything else about playing? You retired back in 2008, so we're 16 years now removed. you know, what is the one thing at the top of the list that you missed the most about those playing days?
The one thing I miss the most, KG, is I miss celebrating wins in the locker room after on the road. And I loved, obviously our fans are incredible and we had so many huge wins over the years in front of our amazing fans, but there was something about going out on the road. And I've been asked that question before over the years. And I often think about like, why do I answer the question the way I do? And I think that I answer the question the way I do is because those years that I played with the Minnesota Wild, we were an expansion team. No one expected much of us. No one believed in us. You know, everybody had a story. And when you go out on the road and you have 20,000 fans yelling at you, telling you you suck, you can't play. Well, we had all heard that before. We know we suck, we can't play, but we think we can play, and that's all that matters. So a lot of times, KG, I think the reason I answer the question the way I do is just because of the way our team was built, you know, those early expansion team years. And I, you know, obviously I played, I think 7 or 8 years I played there with the Wild. And I don't know, I just remember having so much fun before the media would come in the locker room for those 15 minutes. They're just so much fun after winning on the road. And the fact that during that 0-3 run, when we won, you know, the last three games of both those series, two of the three in each series were on the road, was just something that will always, always stay with me. Just winning games on the road and that that 15 minutes you get before the media comes in and just acting like goofballs. And just it was amazing. It's something I'll never forget.
It's a great answer. Okay, we're at the final segment of the show. It's time for the hat trick hot seat. And Wes, again, at this point, there are no wrong answers, just top of the head what comes to mind. If you have a night off as a player, so we're going back to those playing days again, and you get a night off where you can go out there and have a good time, maybe it's a great meal or, you know, whatever entertainment you can find, what was your favorite road NHL city as a player?
Vancouver. Vancouver was my favorite city to go out for dinner. Unbelievable restaurants, and nothing's changed at all. So, and back then, KG, as you know, we played in the same division as Vancouver, so we played them so often. So Vancouver was my favorite city to go out and have a nice meal.
Awesome answer. I love that city. It's probably second to New York for me, but it's just a beautiful place to have an off night. Next question is, you've got a night off at home. Now you're a grandpa, so you take care of the grandkids during the day. Maybe you're tuckered out and you just want to hunker down on the couch and watch a good movie. Maybe one of your all-time favorite movies. Doesn't have to be your very favorite, but if you're just looking to chill and watch a fun movie, which movie are you popping on?
Oh boy. We're not huge movie buffs. Like, I know you live and die with movies, but, if there was, I will say this, my wife and I, when we did have an off night, especially when I played, and we still do now, we do the dinner and movie thing, but, Shawshank Redemption was always one of my favorite movies. And another one that sticks out, and I haven't watched it in probably 30 years, was, and I know you've watched every movie more than once, KG, but you remember the movie called The Jagged Edge?
Oh, it's so good. Oh,
it was a kind of mystery drama thing. And I remember years and years ago, I just remember the end of the movie thinking I'd figured it out. And I'm like, I had nothing figured out. I was completely wrong. And it threw me for such a loop that, and I can't remember all the details of the movie, but it stuck with me that was one of the most interesting endings to a movie that had me completely turned upside down. So probably Shawshank Redemption, if I go back even a few years before that, would be The Jagged Edge.
Yeah, Jagged Edge. Glenn Close is a defense attorney.
Yeah, that's right.
She's defending a would-be murderer in Jeff Bridges, who's accused of this awful murder. And they end up, through the course of this trial process, falling in love. And I don't want to spoil anything more than the fact that it's Jeff Bridges and Glenn Close at their very best. Jagged Edge is a great old school movie. If you haven't seen it, Shawshank Redemption is just one of the best movies of all time, period. It's just phenomenal. But Jagged Edge is one that maybe is off the beaten path that our listeners maybe have missed over the years.
So Siskel and Ebert gives it two thumbs up with Wallace.
Oh, they for sure. They for sure gave it two thumbs up. Final question, and we'll let you go for the day. The first concert that Wes Walls attended, I want to know the band, and I want to know the venue of your very first concert.
My very first concert was in Calgary. I was 20 years old.
Saddle Dome?
What's that?
Had to be the Saddle Dome.
It was actually the Calgary Chorale. It wasn't.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't the Saddle Dome. It was the Calgary Chorale, and it was during Stampede Week. So we have in Calgary, where I grew up, we have a very similar thing to the state tournament or the state fair. It's called the Calgary Stampede. It's a kind of a big deal out there. And Depeche Mode was really, really big in the late 80s. And I had this girl that I was going to meet after the concert at the Calgary Stampede. And I ended up meeting her after that concert. I didn't see her at the concert. She went to the concert, but we agreed to connect and walk around the Stampede grounds together. And her name was Carrie Ann. And I ended up marrying that girl about 4 or 5 years later. So, so Depeche Mode in Calgary, I think we were 18 or 19 years old. And that's it. Depeche Mode. That's all I got.
What a great, of all the times I've asked this question, that is bar none the best answer I've got, because Carrie Ann now is Carrie Ann Walls. And it's a perfect segue.
I chased her around the Calgary Stampede that night, and I never stopped chasing her for about 3 years till she married me.
I love it, Wes. Well,
great
stories, and maybe the best story to close out our conversation here on Wooden Sticks. Really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, KG, thanks for having me. And I've been doing this broadcasting thing here now for 10 or 12 years. And I'll never forget, guys like Anthony and you have really helped give me all kinds of great advice on how to handle situations. And you've been very grateful to me over the years. And I always enjoy spending time with you, KG, anytime, you know that.
Yeah, we share the love of the Minnesota Wild and the hope of a Stanley Cup together, and sweat it out every single day at the rink. And you talk me off the ledge dozens of times every year. I'm not going to get into details there. We're going to let that sit.
Yeah. I'm the cheapest counselor you've ever had, no question.
And trust me, I'm a mental midget. I need all the counseling I can get. I got to be brutally honest. I could have gone another 45 minutes with Wes. Exactly what you heard here today, right? Just a heart and soul guy. He's the same broadcaster that he was as a player. He loves it. He lives it every single day. And when I talk about him talking me off the ledge, listen, we live for wins and big wins and hopefully playoff hockey and down the road a Stanley Cup. And, Wes is a guy that's kind of lived that and knows it. And so when I need a little reassuring, he's always the guy that's been there for me. The players love talking to him, going back and asking questions about playing for Jacques Lemaire. He had such a great career, and he earned everything he got. He worked for it. He gained the respect of his teammates and coaches with the way he approached the game every single day. He's done the same thing now as a broadcaster. He's got that awesome hockey school that my nephew attended for many, many years. It rinks all over the metro, but my nephew Tommy would go out to Woodbury, and it's just great to see Wes Walls a part of the Minnesota Wild organization, from the hockey school to the broadcast to some of the things he does in town with local charities and wounded veterans. This is a guy that gives back. This is a guy that loves Minnesota now and, of course, loves the Minnesota Wild. And that came out today in the show. So I thought it was a perfect time right before the playoffs start. And yes, I get it. This year, the Wild aren't going to be a part of the postseason for the second time in 12 years. And so it's going to be a little bittersweet, because I always look forward to seeing the matchups and mapping out the path to the cup and picking winners and, doing all that fun stuff you do when NHL playoff hockey starts. There's nothing like it. They'll be back. And I think I can say with confidence, they'll be back next year in the playoffs when they're healthy. And for the years to follow, when the Suter and Parisi contracts are gone, as Wes alluded to, some great opportunities to build the depth up top with some star power to help take the pressure off a guy like Kirill Kaprizov. But they've got the good young talent now in this organization, from Rossi to Faber to Boldy to Kirill, and now the goaltending situation, which features now a couple of up-and-comers, including Jesper Wallstedt, which we touched on today. So really fun hockey conversation with Wes Walls today, and look forward to many more of those conversations. We're usually about once a week. You can look for those shows to drop at the tail end of each week. And you can follow me on Twitter at Gorgomatic21 if you want updates on all of our shows. And once again, thank you to Karen Cleary, who does all the work behind the scenes to gather up those great sponsors of our show. Make sure you're a part of it. If you've got a business that needs to be pumped up, email her at K-C-L-E-A-R-Y, K-Cleary, at talknorth.com. I'm Kevin Gorg. You're listening to Wooden Sticks. We'll see you next week.